Hello, this is Peter Lawson, the Flicks the Church Forgot. I'm about to review the new Arrow Video Blu-ray release of Roger Corman-produced Bloodbath and all its various incarnations. If you'd like to see a video version of this with stills and images from the film, then you can check out the video version on YouTube at my YouTube channel, The Flicks the Church Forgot. But this version is the audio one if you prefer to listen on the go or not look at my face. Thank you. Hey everyone, my name is Peter Laws and I'd like to welcome you back to the Flicks the Church Forgot. This is the show where I explore the deeper and occasionally spiritual themes of horror movies. Now there's a whole archive of audio reviews at my website, theflicksthechurchforgot.com, and you can also follow me, if you want to, on Twitter at RevPeterLaws. But for tonight, we are going to wade through a very complicated and fascinating history of one of the most convoluted horror movie productions in history. It's the new Blu-ray set from Arrow Video, cheerily titled Bloodbath. Now, you may well be already aware of the history of Bloodbath, but if you are not, then it really is important and key to understanding the point of these films, to understand the production history, not least to understand why this is not a single disc, but two discs of four different yet very similar looking movies. It's a production history that director Jack Hill once described as one of the weirdest things that has ever happened. So take a deep breath and let's dive in to Bloodbath. In 1963, Roger Corman helped to finance an as-yet unproduced Yugoslavian film which was called Operation Titian. This was a black-and-white spy thriller that explored the art of Italian painter Tiziano Vecelli. Now, Corman wanted to make sure that this foreign film would have domestic appeal, and so he had a few actors, an American actor and an English actor, come in, but also had none other than Francis Ford Coppola to go to Dubrovnik to supervise the film and to Americanize it for the audiences back home. Oddly enough, though, the famed directing genius of The Godfather and Apocalypse Now, he totally screwed the assignment up. Basically, Corman saw the finished film and he was not impressed at all. Now, just as a quick side note, this is not the first time that this had happened between these two men. It was only a few years previously that Roger Corman had financed Francis Ford Coppola's direct-to-horror movie Dementia 13. But when Corman saw the final version of that, apparently, I don't know if this is definitely true, but I read that he stormed out of the screening room and demanded changes, not least to make a more horrific horror movie. And then that's when he called in Spider Baby director Jack Hill, who was quoted before. He wanted him to come and film some new sequences to inject more violence and scares. So Corman is left with this film, Operation Titian, that he doesn't think is releasable, so he decides to make it more of a drive-in movie. He had it rescored, he had it re-edited, and retitled, and that film came under the title of Portrait in Terror. But still, there was something not working about it for Roger Corman, and so he decided in 64 to repeat history. Like with Dementia 13, he hired Jack Hill back to add more horror to Portrait in Terror, to a product that Coppola had overseen under the title Operation Titian. Are you with me? You're following me? So this turned spy thriller Operation Titian into a drive-in movie Portrait in Terror into more of a horror flick called Bloodbath. This was a film inspired in some ways by House of Wax, just in the sense that it's basically this mad artist who kills women and who model for him, and then he dips them in wax to make them into sculptures. Nice. Hill also added a bunch of comedic scenes, with beatniks discussing modern art as well as the definitely ramping up the horror sequences. Certainly within Bloodbath itself, there's a very clear horror sequence where a playmate of the month called Melissa Mathis gets axed to death with a free-flowing monochrome blood sequence. It's definitely one of the scenes where you go, oh yes, this has certainly been injected with horror for the violence-loving 60s audience at the time. So this new version, like I said, was called Bloodbath. But guess what? Roger Corman apparently was still not so keen on it. He still wasn't sure about it, so he shelved the movie for a little bit longer. Now, anyone familiar with the infamous producer Roger Corman will know that he was never a man to let things go to waste. You may know that he reused the exact same burning barn collapsing shot that he filmed for one of his films, one of the films he directed. He used that over and over again in multiple films. And so years later, 1966, Corman returns to Operation Titian, which had become Portrait in Terror and had then become Bloodbath, and he hired a director called Stephanie Rothman to do what she liked with it and to come up with something new. She kept a lot of what Hill had done already, but she pumped in a whole vampire a vampire element to the story. Now the artist was a centuries old undead guy who can handily shapeshift into a completely different man, which this is a stroke of low budget genius, by the way. Basically, it meant that Rothman could now film entire new murder sequences with a completely different actor playing the lead character of the other actor. That's pretty clever. Shock horror, Corman actually liked this version, or perhaps we should put it this way and say he felt this was the least worst attempt, and so he released this, retaining that same title, Bloodbath, and that came out through American International Pictures. Jack Hill, who was the one who made the original Bloodbath version before they changed it with Rothman, he actually was credited along with Rothman as being part of this film, but he said that the changes he felt totally ruined the film. So that is four versions of the film so far, all based on this Operation Titian base coat. But then another version came out, which was a version that was made for TV called Track of the Vampire. And this was made longer because they had to pad it with a whole bunch of extra information. Extra shots were added, though at this point I kind of lost track of which bits came from which version. To be honest, I'm losing track of this history now, so forgive me if I've made mistakes. But basically, if you want the full effect of the padding, then watch Track of the Vampire to see some of the ridiculous extra scenes that they shoehorn in. Linda Saunders dancing on a beach for over 3 minutes. I mean, it's not that necessary. Now, believe me, there are really pointless moments in it, like laugh out loud pointless. There's a chase sequence that's, to be honest, quite boring anyway. It's a chase sequence of this guy wearing a hat chasing this woman on a beach. It's boring anyway, but then to find out that it actually lasts 8 minutes. So anyway, this longer version, Track of the Vampire, came out, this TV version, and that's also present on this disc. Yes, you get four versions of this film on disc. It's a very messy and convoluted production history, but Arrow Video presenting the four main versions on Blu-ray is a really cool way of exploring what's what. So you get the Operation Titian, you get Portrait in Terror, you get Bloodbath, and then you get Track of the Vampire, the last of which has been, that's three of which, pardon me, has been restored in 2K. Now, having Operation Titian available here for the first time, I think it's definitely the first time they've assembled it from various materials. I think that's quite a coup for fans of this film. It's unusual to be able to have gotten that. But anyway, if you get these films, don't expect four different movies. I thought at first it was going to be a collection of four different, like, Roger Corman films, and then realized what was going on. And just be aware that, you know, this isn't four movies. It's one movie that has been cannibalized and then cannibalized again and again and again and again to make four different films, or five if you count the TV version. Now, in many ways, this is a set that is as much about the production history and the business of movies than it is about the films themselves. Indeed, I think there's a brilliant and exhaustive feature-length video essay on Disc 2 by Tim Lucas from Video Watchdog, and he explores the journey these films took in really great detail. And you really ought to watch that if you want to have a true understanding of the backstory of this film, because I find it all a bit too confusing to get my head around. It's too much for my little brain. So with all this in mind, the films themselves, to look at them, I mean, they already have an interesting curiosity value, because they're four different constructions coming out of the same basic building blocks. But after all the fiddling and all the new shoots and the edits, I suppose it's clearly a bit ambitious to expect to find at the end of it a solid and a coherent set of movies to watch. So if you was checking these out, if you bought these unaware of the backstory, I think you may well get really quite frustrated with the choppy and uneven nature of the flow. But once you do know the backstory that we've gone into earlier, it makes the ride and the comparisons a quite fascinating window into the flexibility of film as a medium, how it can be re-edited and reshot and rescored to make new things. However, even though the films are definitely uneven and very much so in the TV version, Track of the Vampire, that's not to say the films aren't enjoyable. I got quite a kick out of the checking out the various versions of Operation Titian, for example. Feels more like a travel documentary. All the way to Track of the Vampire, which is sort of go-go girl, drive-in horror. And I think it's cool to see how this is made possible from the same raw materials. And there are, to be fair, I think, exactly, there's some pretty interesting stuff in the film in terms of cinematography. Some of it looks great. Particularly, I'm thinking, there's some Orson Welles-inspired scenes of a shadowy, hat-wearing figure who's sort of walking down the cobbled, stony streets with brooding buildings looming overhead. They look great. They look really nice and impressive. But then in some versions, this classy stuff gets sandwiched with like shaky cam, amateurish scenes of bikini-clad girls like walking down the street and dancing in the beach. It's like all split lenses and completely unnecessarily, and you get this chase with the woman getting dragged underwater ad infinitum. And Patrick McGee, who's a prominent character in the early versions of this, but in the later versions, he's just pretty much dumped. And yet when he does turn up, when the character does turn up to fit in with the story, he gets like redubbed by some guy and his voice completely doesn't fit. So with all of this jiggery pokery in mind, is that a word? I think it is. I actually found that I mostly enjoyed watching Track of the Vampire, the overly padded version, the combo version, because I just found it funny how it added all of this extra stuff and how it was such a mishmash. Now, Jack Hill in particular doesn't only add the genuine horror moments to this, but into Bloodbath, he pumps a bucket of blood style exploration of characters in the art world. And he has this clan of beatniks who are in a cafe, you know, forever stroking their beards and talking about the powers of quantum art. And it's these arty types who they appeal like comic figures. They spill paint on a page. And they like marvel at how groundbreaking it is. Like, whoa, man, that's amazing. That's something completely radical. And Sid Haig from Spider Baby and The Devil's Reject is one of these freaky beatniks, you know, pontificating about art. It's pretty amusing, this back and forth stuff. I enjoyed that. But it's also cool to see how these figures are not just figures of fun for the whole movie. They do actually redeem themselves. They are quite likable. And Hill doesn't just have them as utter buffoons, well, at least not for all of the time. And as well as this sort of comedy element, which is still quite funny, there are also some quite spooky and powerful moments. For example, the lead character in this, the killer artist, he's called Anthony Sordi, I think it is, and he's tormented by the spirit of a long-dead mistress called Melissa. Melissa or something. Anyway, she laughs and mocks at him through the painting. And it's a pretty cool camera and mirrors effect. She laughs better than that, by the way. At one point, we see inside Sordi's mind, and he's standing with this easel in a desert, with wax bodies strewn around him as the camera pulls back with some great music, revealing a vast landscape of desolation and madness as this woman mocks him. And it's actually a really cool shot. I'm not surprised that Arrow used it in the menu shot for this. And it's a little Fulci-esque, it's a little Dali-esque, it's got really... Actually, the films have got touches of invention in amongst the workman-like attempt to make a decent profitable product, and I just like finding those things in amongst this. Also, at the end of the film, there's a really great moment. I want to spoil it for you, but there's a great moment with sort of wax dolls, and I thought it was really creepy and well done. I'm not sure how they managed to get actors covered in hot wax to be able to like break out of the wax. Like, did they actually pour wax on people? I don't know, but anyway, it looks great. It looks really cool and quite spooky. You know, I've gone all this time without actually mentioning the lead actor in this, and he plays the artist, Sordi, and he's called William Campbell. Now, viewers may well recognize him. I certainly recognize him instantly as the Squire of Gothos from the Star Trek episode of the same name. And he wasn't just in the Squire of Gothos. If you're a Trek fan out there, you may be aware that he was also in the Trouble with Tribbles. He played a Klingon. In this, he's this cool beatnik sort of guy with a quiff and floppy white shirt who may or may not be impotent, hacking up women, but trying to protect a ballerina at the same time that he's fallen in love with, but he's refusing to have sex with her. And it's like, it's almost like this is like Twilight or Teen Wolf or something, like mixed with Poe-esque madness, mixed with Orson Welles imagery, mixed with go-go girls and rinky-dink beach stuff. It's quite the cocktail. Now, yes, these films can be really a bit confusing and bizarre. I find the production history really confusing. I bet I've made a lot of mistakes in explaining them, but they make for a fascinating study of creativity, of taking something and changing it into something else, then something else, and then changing that into something else. Now, of course, it's true to say, and it'd be mad not to say, that the bottom line in Hollywood is often about the money, or always about the money, maybe. But that's not to say that directors, actors, and cinematographers didn't make something, or tried to make something with zero artistic integrity. They didn't. Artists like Sordi and the beatniks in the film, they cannot help themselves from making art out of the most chaotic base materials. And similarly, the people who were involved in all the different versions of this film, they can't stop themselves either from injecting invention even into the chaotic basics that they're putting together to make a film. Yeah, of course, some of the TV versions, some of that is really just filler. But the production backstory, I think, is what makes the film so fascinating. There is a sense, just because they've been made from other films, there's a sense of automatic invention and cleverness in how the films were formulated and put together, warts and all, under this pressure of restriction, because they weren't making a brand new film, they were shoehorning it into old films, old film footage. I think restriction is good in sometimes because it can force you into thinking creatively. I've read of some film directors who remember their early careers with fondness and envy because they remember a time when the lower budget nature of their work, it forced them into being more inventive. They had to be more inventive. But they've said in some interviews, I think John Carpenter, I can't remember who said this, but a director said that now that he had a bigger budget and huge budget, they could basically get whatever they wanted. But they admitted that being forced into economic choices can sometimes make for the better film, for the better artistic product, if you want to call it that. I'm not saying that Bloodbath and the other versions on these discs are works of genuine genius born out of economy. They're not. They're fun, but they're not works of genius. But the principle still remains. The fact that restriction and lack of resources can end up forcing us into like new forms of creative response. I just think that's pretty cool. Interestingly enough as well, if I wanted to apply it even deeper, I can look at my own life and my own spiritual life and I'd say, and say, when do I feel most connected with the idea of there being something beyond this world? When am I most open to there being, like, the potential of a creative force behind all of this around me? When do I want that more? When do I need that more, if you will? Now, it's for me, maybe not for you, but for me, I find that it's not in those times, when I have everything. But it's in those times when things have not gone my way, when I've been restricted. Suffering is not pleasant, and it's not something I would ask for. None of us would ask for it. And yet I have found, just personally speaking, in my own life, that in those times when I have suffered or when I have not had everything, when I have been restricted, it has sparked my mind into new thinking, that my mind is more open and ready to receive something new, new angles on life. When life is perfect, I can get a bit lazy. I can consume life as a sort of happy, bloated spectator rather than build it. That's not to say all suffering's great and we should embrace it and go, whoa, suffering, no. But just to say that sometimes it's when you reach this dead end, you know, you stand looking at it with like frustration and anger, sadness. And maybe it's only then that this new idea props in your head and you say, you know, maybe there's another route through this. Roger Corman, I think he did this sort of dead end hitting multiple times. with Operation Titian all the way up through the various versions to the TV thing Track of the Vampire. And while the results that are paraded here with Arrow are not exactly earth-shattering, they're still really quite cool and interesting and worth preserving and documenting, because you have a case of basically he and others hitting brick walls, and yet they don't give up. They try something else instead. I really like that about Roger Corman. But I also like that about people in general, about you and me, or just human beings. And I just hope the next time that I hit a black hole, I'm sure I will, I hope that I don't have to wait too long for that flash of inspiration to come that says, you know what? You can cross this void in a new and different way. Try that way. It's worth going. Now, Bloodbath is out from Arrow Video on a two-disc set, and it's a really good set of extras on it, especially the aforementioned Tim Lucas video essay, which is really quite in-depth and good. The picture quality of these films, by the way, is great, and for anybody interested in how creativity and the business world clash and combine, I think you would do well to seek this out. However, you've got to be aware that this is not four fully different films, but this is a group of movies that really, it makes more sense to see them as making up a bizarre and fascinating whole. Well, that's it for The Flicks the Church Forgot. Follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws. Find me on Facebook at The Flicks the Church Forgot. Or if you want to, you can read my horror movie column in the print magazine, The Fortean Times. Or check out the FlicksTheChurchForgot.com for a whole bunch of old archive episodes and audio podcasts. This is available as an audio podcast, by the way, if you'd rather listen on the move. But until then, anyway, keep moving forward, and even if you hit a brick wall while you're walking, keep walking in new directions, and don't forget, The Flicks the Church Forgot.